Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is September 15th, 2020, which means that depending on how you count it, we are 48 or 49 days from Election Day, which is really not Election Day. It's the final day for voting. We have special guests today. There's a new book out that just came out. It's actually a rather interesting publishing story. The book's title is After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. And it's published by Lawfare, friends at Lawfare, mainly because other publishers couldn't handle something quite this timely, getting it out before the election. And the authors are Bob Bauer, who served as the White House counsel for President Barack Obama, and Jack Goldsmith, who served as assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel from 2003-2004, and special counsel to the Department of Defense before that. And Jack Goldsmith and Bob Bauer both join me on the podcast. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on. Well, let me start off by reading something that you wrote. The preface begins by imagining some date in the future, maybe this January, maybe 4 years from this January, where someone other than Donald Trump is sworn in as president of the United States. And you write, no matter when it happens or who Trump's successor is or whether other issues demand attention, some of the most momentous and difficult questions the next president of the United States will face concern how to reconstruct the battered and much changed presidency that Trump will have left behind. And then you describe the Trump presidency this way. Trump operated the presidency in ways that defied widely held assumptions about how a president might use and abuse the powers of the office. His mercurial personality, pathological mendacity, shamelessness, open disrespect for laws and norms, vicious attacks on officials and institutions, intermingling of public and private interest, and indifference to facts did enormous damage to the great office that he assumed on January 20th, 2017, and his words and actions exposed the presidency's vulnerability to dangerous excesses of authority and dangerous weaknesses in accountability. Trump was not the first president to raise these dangers, obviously, but he did so unlike any of his predecessors. So, wow, how do you put all that back together again? I guess the biggest shock, and I don't know who wants to take this, but the biggest shock for a lot of us was finding out how much raw power the president had, as you point out, and how weak the checks and balances are. I mean, and you address that in your book, don't you? Jack, do you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you so much for having us on. So I've studied the presidency for three decades, and I thought I knew how it worked. And I learned a lot from the Trump presidency because it made me realize the extraordinary extent to which constraints on the presidency in part depended upon the integrity, good faith, and reasonableness and good conscience of the person who occupied the office. And a lot of us have had the reaction that you've had, namely that there are extraordinary number of constraints on the presidency that are just embodied in norms rather than law that's enforceable, and that the legal constraints on the presidency, while robust, are full of loopholes. So Trump has really just operated the presidency in a way that exposed many areas of weak accountability, many areas where there's not adequate constraint. And I want to add that the book is not just about Trump's follies. I mean, this builds on things we've learned about the presidency over the past few decades. There was, an important set of reforms after Watergate in the 1970s that addressed a whole raft of issues with the presidency and its excessive powers and absence of accountability in many areas. And those constraints worked for a while, but they've been diminishing, and then they really reached a tipping point, I think, in the Trump administration.
So, Bob Bauer, one of the things that I think we did learn is that a lot of these constraints was an honor system, right? I mean, it was assumed that the person in the Oval Office was honorable, as Jack just mentioned. So, your book deals with you have 50 recommendations for how to fix the presidency. I want to start with this question of how do you restrain the abuses of power in the presidency? Because again, this goes to kind of the shock, and especially with Bill Barr around, who basically says, yeah, you can do anything you want. There are no real constraints. We've seen the limitations of impeachment power. We've seen the reluctance of the courts to step in. So what can be done to restrain the abuses of power, what we think of the abuses of power, but which are apparently among the inherent abilities of somebody in the Oval Office to pull off?
Well, as you mentioned, we have a mix of statutory reforms and then also reforms that depend on an administration that is prepared to embark on a reasonable degree of self-regulation. And our hope is that the combination of both statutory reform and revised internal regulation will go a long way toward constraining a number of the abuses I think that you have in mind, and that will help to actually restore these battered norms to a level of visibility and, frankly, a level that commands respect that they have lost a lot of ground on in the last several years.
Well, give me an example of that. What statutory changes can be enacted that would restrain an executive with this much authority?
I'll go to one that's actually pretty straightforward, do with prohibiting financial conflicts of interest. Trump, of course, refused to release his tax returns. That was an absolutely norm-based effort, norm-based compliance by presidents since Jimmy Carter, and of course included both presidential candidates and presidents themselves. By the way, also vice presidential candidates and presidential candidates. Trump said on an obviously bogus excuse that he was going to one day release them, but not now while he's in audit, under audit, though he said he's always under audit. We can go into some length about that, but I'm sure your listeners have heard a great deal about that already. And then you take that together with his willingness to put together a porous, quote unquote, trust that has actually permitted him to continue to be deeply involved in a business, in a family business, that I think it certainly can be argued has benefited significantly and openly from association with his presidency. And so there are real holes in statutory requirements that permit a president who's inclined to do what Trump has done, and who in modern times is the only president who's been inclined to do what he's done, to go ahead and sort of run the business concurrently with the presidency. And there are holes that can be plugged. There are clearly statutory reforms. We lay them out in some detail, both for tax disclosure, but also more broadly for financial conflict of interest, that can constrain at least that abuse of power.
Okay, so follow-up question here, and I don't mean this to be snarky, okay? You can pass all of these statutes, but if you have a president who says, who's going to make me? Who is going to make them? Jack, I mean, one of the things that we've discovered is that you can be the president, you can break the law, but who has standing, who has the ability or the will to actually enforce the law?
Well, I think I disagree with your premise a little.
Okay.
Listen, Trump is an extreme president, and to many people, a scary president, largely because of his rhetoric and the thing he pledges and tries to do. First point I would make is, while we firmly believe that there's need for significant reform here, I think you're exaggerating the extent to which Trump successfully flouted the law, to the extent to which he wasn't constrained. There are many, many examples, but the fact is that the courts have pushed back on many of his lawless initiatives, as courts often do for presidents. The fact is that if you think back about the Mueller investigation, many people thought that the Mueller investigation was not going to be completed, that Trump was going to exercise his undoubted power to ensure that Mueller was fired, and the like. And we now know from the Mueller report that Trump tried to shut it down, and people inside his own White House wouldn't let him. And that's because of some laws and norms that were still operating and still efficacious, even in the Trump administration. Our goal is to clarify and build up those norms and laws. But I think it's wrong to say that Trump just got away with everything and was lawless. I think that he certainly gave that appearance because of the way he talked and acted. But often his bark was less significant than his bite. And often, at least until Barr presents a more complicated case, but at least until Barr, the political appointees in the Justice Department didn't follow his wishes. They didn't prosecute his opponents and the like. So I just think that there was more constraint in the system under Trump, and I think there's reason for optimism to that improving those constraints in the future.
But that, by the way, I certainly hope you're right about this. But those are, I would say, those are the soft restraints that people still did the right thing. But if you, let's imagine a second term in which you don't have these people around, people who don't do the right thing, who go along with what the president says, how do you write laws? Because the Constitution does not self-enforcing. Laws are not self-enforcing. So let's say that you have a second term and you have Bill Barr that says, you know what, you can shut down anything you want. You can do anything you want. You can pardon anyone you want. You can fire anyone you want. And we're going to go along with it. Then really, is there a statutory way of dealing with that?
Listen, if Trump is reelected, there is no doubt that all the norms and laws that have been in play the last 4 years are going to be under more pressure. I think there'll still be more efficacious than you say, but there's no doubt that they will definitely be more threatened if he wins the election. But I'll just say a couple of things. Both of the examples you mentioned were examples where the president has clear power mm-hmm. to fire subordinate executive officials,
right,
and the power to pardon. We do have suggestions in the book for narrowing those powers where it's legally possible and in ways that we do think can be self-enforcing. But let me just say, what you just described is exactly what we're trying to deal with.
Yes.
Trump wins again, these norms and laws are going to be under even more pressure, no doubt. Our goal is, if the next president is not Trump or after Trump is gone, is to try to fix the system going forward so that future Trumps won't be able to exploit the system quite so well.
All right, but I want to follow up on that, because in the preface, you do talk about, and in the first part of your book, you do talk about among the changes to protect against abuses, to constrain misuse of the pardon power. Well, the pardon power certainly looks sweeping. What is the misuse of the pardon power, and how would you possibly constrain something that is explicitly granted to the president in the Constitution?
In the book, we try to show that there has been a vast overstatement about how sweeping the pardon power is. It's certainly a very broad power. There's no question about that. But that there are no limits on the pardon power, we believe to be wrong. And we lay out the reason why we think that is the case. And then we talk about some very specific statutory reforms, which we think would withstand constitutional challenge. And they would prevent a president from essentially engaging in bribery or obstruction of justice using the pardon power, using some offer of clemency or pardon to induce a false witness testimony. And likewise, we also argue that, first of all, the Office of Legal Counsel, though not in a terribly deeply reasoned opinion to say the least, has said that presidents cannot self-pardon. We don't think presidents should be able to self-pardon, and we think Congress has the authority to prohibit them from self-pardoning. And to your point about can statutes actually constrain, I just want to mention that, and we note this in the book, I mean, there are limits to what, under most conceivable circumstances, an attorney general is going to bless a president to do. Even Barr has said, you know, pardons can't be sold. A president can't go into the business of offering pardons for campaign contributions or for personal payment. And so there are, we think, limits. The problem is they need to be, you know, clearly defined and delineated within constitutional bounds. And in respect to the pardon power, we've done that. I'll add furthermore that we've had an opportunity, because we were asked when we published a piece on lawfare, giving a preview of our pardon power recommendations. We heard from the House Judiciary Committee that wanted to discuss that with us. And it has now a bill moving, passed through the House Judiciary Committee, with statutory limits on the pardon power.
One other question on the pardon power that came up during after the pardon of Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona. Can the president say to a government official, I want you to violate the law, including violating people's civil rights, and I promise you that if you do, I will pardon you? That's not bribery. That's not self-pardoning. I guess this of course came up. I think it was Miles Taylor from the Department of Homeland Security who said that, who has alleged that the president told immigration officials that if they violated the law, he wanted them to violate the law, that he would pardon them if they got in trouble for it. Is there any way to restrain that sort of an abuse? I think it's an abuse, but is would that be the kind of abuse that can be restrained by statute, Jack Goldsmith?
We think so, because to the extent that what you're talking about is the president offering a pardon to induce someone to obstruct justice. And I'd like to know more about the facts, but to the extent that's what you're talking about, yes, we do believe that can be regulated, and we propose it a regulation specifically on that point. The theory is this: you can't stop the president. The president has extraordinarily broad powers to pardon. But the pardon power, pardoning the sheriff for his act of obstruction of justice wouldn't prevent Congress from criminalizing a separate crime of obstruction of justice there. You could get in a tit for tat where the president kept pardoning for the subsequent crime, but yes, we do think that there's space under current law and under Article 2 to regulate obstruction of use of a pardon to obstruct justice.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
So now this becomes a little bit circular. We'll get into your second section, which is, of course, let's say that there's a law that says that you cannot abuse your power this way. Then is it up to the Department of Justice to enforce that? Because what if you have a Department of Justice that sees itself as an extension and a protector of the president?
Well, a couple of things there. One, it doesn't have to be the current
Right.
enforcing that criminal prohibition. We have a lot of discussion about how officials inside one administration can be subject to criminal scrutiny under another. I think that's the main check, but you shouldn't discount. I really think it's important not to discount. We're assuming really worst case scenarios here where we have
right.
presidents even more lawless than Trump. I have no doubt that Trump is going to continue to use the pardon power opportunistically and probably in unprecedented ways. But even if you have a president like that, I don't think Bill Barr would go along with a lot of these things. But even if you have that, to make these things happen, it requires lots of other officials in the department to go along. And we saw that's the place at which law and norms can really have a bite and really slow down initiatives like this. And then, of course, if it's really obstruction of justice in exchange for a pardon, that's the kind of thing Congress can criminalize and can be enforced by the next administration. And that in turn, let me say one more thing, that in turn, once it's laid out and explained, has a significant incentive effect on the people considering whether to do this. We saw that a lot even during the Trump administration.
So in your preface, you talk about, in your entire part two of the book, you talk about, again, the Justice Department, the complicated relationship between the White House and the Justice Department. The problems here range from the danger of politicized prosecution to deficiencies in the special counsel regulations to inadequate guidance for FBI investigations of presidential campaigns and presidents to the problem of a too powerful White House counsel's office. This strikes me as one of the revelations to a lot of people outside the administration was the quasi-independence of the Justice Department, but how fragile it can be if you have certain kinds of attorney generals and certain kinds of presidents. So talk to me a little bit about what can be done to regularize the relationship or to guarantee some sort of independence to a Justice Department that is part of the executive branch.
So there's an example, again, of where norms matter a great deal. And the White House counsel's office has been, of course, a controversial office from the very beginning because there was a concern that the president was establishing through the White House counsel's office, which has grown in influence and size over time, a cadre of lawyers characterized primarily by their loyalty to him or her and willingness to do as told. That's been very much overdrawn, and there's no question the president does need legal advice at hand in the West Wing. But there is a concern that if the White House counsel's office is tied to the president too closely personally and politically, that it becomes the agent for a slow erosion in the independence of the legal advice that is provided to the president. it becomes also the agent for a relationship with the Department of Justice that also becomes too cozy. So we actually believe, and I have to say, I've come to this conclusion reluctantly, it's the best job I've ever had. And I have great respect for many of the former occupants of the White House counsel's office and believe that that office has to continue. But having said that, we believe that it ought to be downsized and that the balance of power between the legal advisory team in the White House and the legal advice available to the Justice Department should be redressed, and more of that legal advice ought to be situated within the Department of Justice for any number of reasons, not the least of which, and I'll stop here, is that it is important for lawyers to operate more in the culture that is generally the culture of the Department of Justice. And I understand people say, oh, what do you mean? How could that possibly be when we live in the age of, say, the widely criticized Bill Barr? But as Jack pointed out a minute ago, when you start to get below that into the professional ranks, you know, you find that there is a culture of professionalism that over time has given the department the reputation as something distinctive and very special in the executive branch. And that's a healthier environment. Obviously, the political hothouse that is the West Wing, that is to say, a healthier environment for lawyers. So we propose a White House counsel who would continue to support the president with a small number to enable the White House counsel to do his or her job, but that, you know, beyond, you know, oversight management, scandal management, any number of other, you know, responsibilities that you would expect a lawyer close at hand to the president would perform, that the core legal analysis and responsibility for advising the president legally should reside at the Department of Justice, and we suggest how.
Okay, so Jack Goldsmith, you talk about the danger of politicized prosecution, and this is obvious to a lot of folks. If Donald Trump calls in a U.S. attorney and says, I want you to criminally charge Charlie Sykes, and the prosecutor does not respect the norms of the office and says, yes, boss, what are the constraints on that, at least before we get to the courts?
So what are the constraints now, and what are the constraints that we propose?
Right.
So yes. Right now, so the obstruction of justice statutes apply to the people in the Justice Department being asked to do that. It would depend on why they were prosecuting you. There are constraints in the department now on the way that journalists can be prosecuted. But it's a hard, hard problem, and here's why. It is a hard problem, and here's why. And this came up after Watergate, and there was a big discussion about it then as well. It's wrong to think that politics can be removed, or even should be removed, from law enforcement, because every president, this was something that, again, we had a debate about in Watergate. Let me explain what I mean. Every president comes in with having been elected with an agenda about, and that agenda includes prosecution priorities. So one president might come in and say, I want to really ramp up prosecutions on abuse of police, and I want to really ramp up child porn prosecutions and the like. And the line between that, which is totally acceptable, and which the Attorney General can shift priority based on political considerations, the line between that and prohibited politicized prosecutions, going after your enemies, is often very hard to discern. So the danger is you can impose too many limitations on the Justice Department and basically not allow it to serve justice as the president who is elected to serve justice sees fit. That said, we do worry about exactly the type of politicized prosecutions you talked about. We face up to the very many difficulties of addressing those. And I'll just give you some of the things we suggest. One is that, especially with regard to the press, which we think is most vulnerable in this situation and has been most vulnerable under the Trump administration, because the law enforcement can be used to seriously harm and retaliate against the press. We expressly empower the Inspector General to review such law enforcement investigations or prosecutions. And we expressly give an inspector general the authority to report those findings to Congress. That's one idea. Another idea is limits on the types of investigations that can be done by one administration another, that's another form of retaliatory prosecution. But listen, at the end of the day, there's not much that can be done if a Justice Department, consistent with the law, decides to pick out someone who's a political enemy if there is an independent criminal basis for it. Ultimately, a lot of these things turn on the public and publicity and the norms surrounding those type of things to not make it happen. I will remind you, let me just say one more thing if that doesn't sound very convincing. Trump asked his Justice Department, we document this, about 12, 14 different times for different people. Prosecute my enemies, do this, do that. It didn't happen. We have the Durham investigation going on right now, and we'll see what the fruits of that are. But it just didn't happen. Even the Department of Justice under his thumb, even the Barr Department of Justice, did not follow his wishes on that. It's much, much harder to do than you think.
Now, that is interesting. You mentioned the Durham investigation, which is happening in real time, where you had one of the high-ranking officials in that investigation resigning, apparently because she felt that there was undue pressure on the investigators to come up with something before the election. Is that the kind of mechanism you're talking about? Is that people will basically say, look, I'm not going along with this, and I'm going to go public with the fact that we're being pressured to come up with a potentially politicized result?
Yes, and you've seen this work. You saw this work when Berman resigned in the Southern District of New York as the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Barr tried to put in a presidential supporter. Berman wouldn't stand down. The public rallied around Berman, including some Republicans in Congress, and Barr was forced to step down and to put forth as the acting U.S. attorney someone who had been a career prosecutor in the U.S. attorney's office. Those mechanisms are much more effective than is appreciated. They have worked quite robustly, which is not to say perfectly, during the Trump administration. And we try to buck up those type of norms to make them even more efficacious going forward.
All right. The third part of your book deals with, and we've talked about this a lot on this podcast over the years, the way in which power has shifted so dramatically from Congress to the president in recent decades, and given the president, so much discretion, by the way, including, control over nuclear weapons. So let's talk about that. And, Bob, I guess, maybe step back from this a moment, because one of the things that I found puzzling about Republicans who've gone along with so much of what President Trump has done is their lack of imagination of what a Democratic president can do. That now that we're seeing how much you can do with a pen and a phone, you might remember those phrases. That if in fact Republicans have said that they're okay with sweeping executive orders and the unilateral decision making of the president, what will they have to say when it's a President Biden or a President Kamala Harris or a President Bernie Sanders or anyone else in that office? Is there a widespread understanding among Democrats that perhaps the powers of the presidency vis-a-vis Congress have just grown disproportionately, frighteningly?
There, of course, in the wake of Donald Trump, the extent to which these weaknesses, as we say, have been exploited, I think, has absolutely struck people pretty hard. Because there do not appear to be any guardrails, respect for institutions or norms in Trump. And at the end of the day, no matter how far presidents may seem to have gone, particularly in the eyes of the opposition party, there always appeared to be some limit beyond which they might not go. We can have an argument about that. There's some presidents who may have, gone maybe even by bipartisan consensus quite off the rails. But for the most part, the view was that presidents might push extremely hard and really challenge norms and skirt rules, but that there was some limit beyond which they would not go. I'm going to set Watergate and Nixon aside for the purposes of this discussion at the moment, because I think that's a separate and complicated question. But you are quite right that these criticisms have tended to be somewhat opportunistic. So the sins that we don't tolerate in the other side are sins we might tolerate a little bit more on ours, maybe behind some notion, I believe it was Roosevelt who deployed the fabled quotation, the sins of the warm-hearted and the sins of the cold-hearted are weighed on different scales. But I think Trump has been a shock to the system. And I think there is a basis, and Jack and I discussed this in our book, for a recognition of by both parties that we have to bring an end to this what's good for the goose is good for the gander, or what's lost for the goose is lost for the gander. There really has to be a recognition under what we kind of describe as a sort of golden rule that the only way to think about these issues is to try to put yourself in, on the other side and say to yourself, well, is this conduct I'm engaging in, would it be tolerable to me if it was engaged in by the other side? If one administration can do it, shouldn't it also be true, or shouldn't, if one administration doesn't do it or can't do it, shouldn't that also be true? The same prohibition should apply on the other side? So I do think Trump has opened up the opportunity for that more, if you will, broad-minded debate.
You would think so, but it's kind of a prisoner's dilemma, like who goes first, right? Are you going to give up the power first, or am I going to give up the power first? One of the things you recommend, though, is reining in some of the presidential emergency powers. This is one thing that I think was really quite extraordinary. I certainly did not imagine that the president could unilaterally impose massive tax increases in the form of tariffs. I was not aware that the president Congress had ceded so much power to the president through the emergency powers. It's basically a blank check. It's like we have this system, three branches of government and checks and balances, except in an emergency, in which case you got it all. So talk to me about your recommendations for reining back the emergency powers.
I'll take that one. You're absolutely right. The emergency powers, Congress has delegated authority to presidents upon declaration of an emergency that basically lets the president do, if it's related to economic affairs, especially, just about whatever he or she wants. And Trump has the Huawei stuff, and a lot of his, almost all of his emergency powers have been exercised under IEPA, and he's not the only president to do that. The threat to ByteDance and TikTok, and basically our whole foreign economic policy, or a lot of it, has been subsumed under these emergency powers. So we focus mostly on the Insurrection Act, which is the domestic power that goes back 200 years to, in which Congress basically gave the president a blank check to send out the military into basically the homeland to put down insurrection and basically widespread disregard of federal law. It's too much of a blank check. There's actually bipartisan support. I'm not saying enough for a majority yet, but bipartisan support to rein this in. We basically propose tightening up the definitions for when the president can do this, but most importantly, limiting this power, not making it endless, but limiting it to just 30 days and requiring Congress to basically approve it if it wants to continue. So that's the basic reform. With regard to, there are other elements of that involving consultation and the like, but the basic idea is that Congress has to reassert itself in approving these things. Maybe the president needs some discretion for a short period of time, but there's no justification. Some of these emergency powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act go back to the 1970s. The original Carter Emergency Declaration with regard to the Iran hostages, believe it or not, has been renewed by every president and is still in place.
Really?
The original Clinton Emergency Power with regard to the Cuban shootdown in 1996 has morphed and transformed, but been approved by every president since. The essential power problem, is when Congress gave the president these emergency powers, it left itself what was then called the legislative veto, which allowed it, without enacting a new law, to stop the president, either by one house or a two-house vote, and without the need to override a veto. And that was a pretty good check on these emergency powers.
Certainly
better than we have now.
Yeah.
But the Supreme Court declared that power unconstitutional in a case called Chadha. And that case had a massive impact on shifting power to the president because it took away one of Congress's main checks. So Congress needs to completely rethink the nature of these delegated powers it gave to the president. Again, this is easier said than done because it really takes fortitude on behalf of Congress to sort of exercise its responsibilities in ways that it hasn't been inclined to do for decades.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is a puzzle for me that you, I mean, obviously they have been reluctant to exercise their power. You would have thought that they would have jealously guarded those prerogatives. I mean, there's a long history of parliaments and congresses who are willing to push back against executives, even executives that they're aligned with, because they don't want to be reduced to potted plants. Why has the American Congress been so reluctant to do its job? Why have they been so willing to go along with their subordination to the imperial presidency? Bob, do you have any ideas, any insight into all that? I mean, if I'm a United States senator, you know, I'm gonna guard my power, right? I'm gonna push back if it's encroached upon. But that's not been happening.
It's a complicated question, but I think one piece of it, and I'm not being especially original on this point to say the least, one piece of it is that their political fortunes and the way they think of the way they fit into the political geography has less to do with the institution of the Congress itself than their party affiliation.
Yeah,
we have what has been called a separation of parties, not powers. And so there is just a view that at the end of the day, it is the survival of the party in Congress as a, if you will, partisan unit affiliated with an incumbent president that matters more than potentially taking what would be a midterm or long-term institutional view that may be harmful to the president's program, and if harmful to the president's program, opposed by the president, who then puts tremendous pressure on members of his or her own party to follow suit. And that is a fundamental, I think that is fundamental. Now, the sources of that are complex. I've described something that I think is happening without telling you why it's happening that way, why it's happened that way over time. But I definitely think it's the increase in polarized partisanship and the way that that is viewed as sort of the controlling factor and a decrease in a sense of institutionalism.
I think that's definitely true. So here's one of the things that you write about that is going to generate a lot of interest. You talk about adjusting the norms that should govern the examination of criminal allegations against a former president. So let's talk about that. What are the norms that govern the examination of criminal allegations against former presidents? We've been very reluctant to look back at former presidents. Famously, Richard Nixon was pardoned, and there's really been no attempt in our political history to do anything about former presidents. So what do you envision?
So this is a very complicated and difficult issue. And because, as you say, we generally have not been in the business as a country of investigating past presidents or past administrations for criminal law violations. There are a few exceptions, but of course, Ford pardoned Nixon, so there's never any post-presidency prosecution there. The Obama administration did a narrow review of some of the interrogation practices of the Bush administration, even though career prosecutors had looked at it. But on the whole, it's been thought to be dangerous to the democracy to look back like this. Trump presents kind of a challenging case. So we basically say two things. One, we have guidelines for how one administration should look at the actions of a prior administration in terms of investigating it. Because that's exactly what you have Barr doing now through the Durham investigation of the investigation that went on of the Trump administration, the Obama administration officials. And we basically think on that it shouldn't be done by a prosecutor, that that's too dangerous and too political. We think that the investigation should be done by an inspector general who has more independence and more credibility in terms of finding facts about what might have gone on before, if there's any investigation. We think that any criminal investigation has to be done by a special counsel and not by the attorney general himself. On the question of Donald Trump, this is one issue where Bob and I had a friendly disagreement in the book, and we talked about it quite explicitly in the book about what should be done about Trump. I'll let Bob speak for himself. But my view is, I have no doubt that there is a valid criminal investigation to be done for Trump's in-office actions. I think that any such prosecution would be legally very difficult to conduct, and I think would also be politically terrible for the country, probably for the next Biden administration. And I think it probably would be not worth the cost But Bob has a different view.
We do lay this disagreement out. It's the only place where we decided to air a disagreement and weren't able to hammer out a common view. I think it is very important to rule of law principles, the restoration of rule of law norms and principles, to have a transparent process, but at the same time, a rigorous process of accountability for whatever it is concluded needs to be investigated and maybe in the end prosecuted in the case of Donald Trump. What bedeviled Ford, I think, and wound up costing him a great deal of trouble. Some say it led to his defeat in 1976. I'm not certain that's true, but it certainly damaged the presidency and brought his approval ratings crashing to the ground, is that it was apparently a standardless exercise of the pardon power. It wasn't clear on what basis he was proceeding. He gave different grounds. It was conducted in secret. It was rushed so that the pardon was granted within a month of Nixon's departure from office. In my view, the public ought to see that there is a process in effect, an independent process in effect for investigating and determining the president's accountability under law for any misconduct, any violations of law committed while in office, that needs to be done pursuant to some of the procedures that we've recommended, by the way, for the conduct of that kind of an investigation to assure that it's not subject to suspicion of politicization, that it should be carried all the way through to the conclusion. And if there's an argument that on some violations, if not all violations, the president ought to consider a pardon or a commutation or whatever, that needs to be on the basis of principles that are articulated clearly. It has to be on the basis of a pardon that the president, that former President Trump or any former president should specifically ask for. And there ought to be wide consultation between the president and other stakeholders, which includes the Congress. But any sort of inside job here, if you will, or rushed attempt in the name of national unity to excuse all of that, I think is going to be extraordinarily damaging. I will close by saying we now have OLC opinions that immunize the president from prosecution while in office. And if we proceed to give presidents, and I'm overstating the case here, a pass upon leaving office in the interest of national healing, we'll have a law that prevents them from being indicted while in office and a norm that prevents them from being prosecuted after they leave office. And to me, that makes no sense under any kind of rule of law regime.
Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. The book is After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. It is out. Paperback, you can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it on Kindle. It's published by Lawfare. It is up to date. It is highly relevant, very much a roadmap for the next presidency, whether it begins this January or in January, 4 years from now. So again, Bob Bauer, Jack Goldsmith, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are 48 days to go until Election Day.